Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. What is it going to take to reboot the American economy? With growth slumping again and projections of a long slump, that question is more urgent than ever. Today, we'll ask deans of top business schools across the country how they see the way forward and about their role, the role of their grads, in the turnaround. This hour on Point, the reboot and American B schools. You can join the conversation. Are you looking to American B schools to lead the way or not? And what do you want to hear from our top B school leaders? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later this hour, we'll look at the big California court injunction on Don't Ask, Don't Tell worldwide and ask what comes next. But first, our B school superstars. With me in the studio is Nithin Noria, newly minted dean of Harvard Business School. Since July, Indian-born, MIT grad-schooled, now at Harvard. Nithin Noria, welcome to On Point. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
With us from Evanston, Illinois, is Sally Blount, dean of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. Also the brand new boss since July, snagged back by Northwestern from a top post at NYU. Sally Blount, it's been a while. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. It's good to hear you.
And from Berkeley, California, Richard Lyons is here, dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley, former chief learning officer at Goldman Sachs from 2006 to 2008. Richard Lyons, Dean Lyons, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Tom.
Nithin, let me start with you. You're right here. We've got all these tough reports about the economy. Economists saying, you know, growth is going to be lower than they thought, and it's going to be low for a long time. Where does the reboot come in? What's the role of B schools in finding it, in sparking it?
So America has always been a remarkably innovative society, and I think the prospects for America always lie in being at the frontiers of innovation and entrepreneurship and creating the new industries and the new economies for tomorrow. So as much as we feel right now we're in a moment where we're going sideways, I have a great confidence in the American economy and in the imagination of American entrepreneurs to take this economy forward. And that's what we as business schools have to be preparing our students for as well, to be innovative, to create the opportunities that will drive America forward.
Point to one, two, three specific industries that you see as workhorses, engines of a restart.
So clearly, healthcare is one of the sectors that is fast growing and will create not just opportunities for cost saving, but also opportunities for entrepreneurship. The clean tech sector is a big sector, and we see lots of opportunities in the clean tech sector as well. And even finance, which has become a sector that a lot of people think is in disrepute. Regulatory changes are often the engine for a lot of change in the economy and often entrepreneurship at the end of it. So I think we will see some remarkable changes in finance as well that will create new opportunities for the American economy.
Sally Blount, where are you looking for a restart, and do we need a new approach to find it? You know, some people look at B schools and say, listen, guys, gals, in your case, you've got some responsibility on your hook for some of the bumps that we've hit in the last year, Sally.
Well, the restart of the economy is going to come from jobs and fluid markets that can fund the creation of jobs. And a lot of that is sticking to the fundamentals. I think a lot of what we've learned since 2008 about the economy is that we need regulation, that we need rules of play for creating opportunities. We're sticking with what we've been teaching, and we're learning along with the rest of society about how complex markets in a globalized world work.
Complex markets in a globalized world. And within that, you know, where do you see potential engines here? You're sitting there right in the heart of the Midwest, the old industrial belt of this country. Is it going to be there? Is there a new realm of manufacturing? Or, I mean, do services still cut it? Where are you looking for a restart? People are really paying attention and want to know now.
I think consumer products are a key piece if we build on top of what Nithin's talked about. I mean, everyone talks about how the importance of consumer spending, getting that reinvigorated. And in the heartland, that's what we're about exactly. We do a lot in manufacturing. We do a lot in basic services and professional services. And just, you know, interacting with our consumers and building businesses that meet needs. and that solve problems. It's the basics of what the American enterprise has always been about.
Can we compete with much lower wage markets in bringing that back if it's consumer products there in the heartland and elsewhere? Can we make those in a competitive fashion?
We can certainly design them. I think that's what we learn year in and year out. And we have to keep investing in education, both at the, you know, grade school levels, high school levels, college levels, and university levels, to continue to be thought leaders. Manufacturing is what started us, but it was innovation and creativity which has really propelled us forward. And if we're going to stay ahead in the developing and developed world, we have to continue to be thought leaders and invest in education.
Thought leaders, critical, everybody knows it. But I know from hearing from many, many callers to this show, people have become, everybody wants that, but at the same time, they're a little skeptical, a little jaundiced about it. You can be design leaders and thought leaders and not produce those jobs you mentioned, Sally. What about that piece? I mean, does it come with employment, not just for your grads, if they're lucky, we hope, but for a whole lot of Americans? We can't, you know, we've got 9.5% unemployment.
We absolutely have 9.5% unemployment, but we also have an incredible spirit embedded within the American people that we have to keep energizing. And one of the things that we're all learning in this globalized, complex economy of ours is that the rules of game or of play are changing constantly. And what we have to do is educate people who can respond to those changing rules of play. It's not obvious right now what the answer is, but it wasn't obvious 15 years ago that we would circle the globe with the internet in as brief a period of time as we did. You and I cannot imagine what's coming. All we can do is equip the next generation with the ability to navigate unprecedented levels of social and economic, both complexity and uncertainty. And that's what universities are here for, to teach people how to think. And if we keep investing in making people stronger thinkers, that's the only way we're going to get out of this box.
Richard Lyons, you're there in California at the Haas School at Berkeley, listening to all this, and you've been writing recently. Our economy may need to go back to school. You've written that the MBA itself, B schools, the grads, the whole program needs to go back to school. What do you mean by that?
Well, there are obviously a lot of challenges facing us, as well as a lot of opportunities. Society in general, and the business sector more specifically, has looked at business schools and said, "Look, you need to change." And there are fundamentals that Sally mentioned that we have to continue delivering. People have to be able to do the finance, the marketing, the strategy, et cetera. As we go further, though, and ask, well, what are some of the things that we need to do differently? One of the things I will put on the table, if you ask the person on the street or you ask your listeners, Tom, whether they believe that business schools have been breeding grounds for overconfidence and self-focus, you will get nods, vigorous nods.
Yep.
Now, we do not intentionally do that. I believe that we have unintentionally done that to a degree, and that is one of the elements that we need to think a lot harder about.
You've written that the way we do business is not sustainable. You had a piece in The Economist not long ago. You said these are commercial paths where straight line continuations don't work. The straight line will hit a wall. What are you talking about there?
Well, thank you. I think these are commercial pathways in areas like healthcare expenditure, in areas like public education, or if we thought about access to safe water around the world, or carbon, or many other of these elements of our society. Healthcare expenditure, it is now about 17-18% of GDP in the U.S., forecast to get up near 50% with reasonable extrapolations in my kids' lifetimes. Those are numbers that just can't happen. So the question then is, how do we bend those pathways? What kinds of leaders do business schools need to put in the system today so that 20 or 30 years from now, the kinds of path-bending changes in many of these industries will occur and can occur?
Nathan Noria with me in the studio. You're at Harvard Business School. Are you looking to turn out path-bending leaders, or does the business world out there just want, you know, fired up hot shots who are going to make them great quarterly profits right now and bend the path? You know, that's for somebody else.
I mean, the amazing thing about MBAs is that they go and work in all walks of society. You know, people think that we only turn out MBAs that go and become consultants or investment bankers. But the reality is that we have people who go and work for social enterprises. We have people who go and work for small firms, for startups, for large companies, for consumer product companies. If you think about the 900 MBAs at Harvard Business School, they go out and serve society and businesses in all walks of life. I think what people want of us is leaders who can contribute to all of these different types of organizations in society, because frankly, there's nothing in the world that I can think of that is going to get meaningful solutions happen without business playing a meaningful role.
Okay, that's great. It sounds sweet, but still more than half, by my latest numbers anyway, of your grads at Harvard go into finance and consulting. That's 31% to financial services, class of 09, 26% to consulting, you know, manufacturing 8, technology 7. I mean, it's different B-schools. But is there a market for path-bending leaders who aren't going to do the same old thing? I mean, Wall Street's making pretty great profits right now. Maybe they just want right now, in spite of what we see for growth projections and what we see in employment. Do they just want more of the same? Pour on the gas, let's go. We'll make a lot of money. Those big bonuses, a lot of your grads have gone there. Or, you know, can we count on B-schools to bring us the kind of change everybody on this panel today says we're going to need?
So, in fact, you know, in the last several years, it's worth noting that we've had more students leave Harvard Business School and start companies straight as entrepreneurs. So we've had 45 students last year, which is 5% of our class, but 45 new companies. If any one of them becomes the next Google, or any one of them becomes the next Facebook, or any one of them becomes the next Walmart, we could have created more value than you might imagine.
Or finds the alternative energy, we hope.
Yeah, so we hope. You know, so we have 45 students who, an equal number that joined social enterprises of various kinds, which is a rapidly increasing numbers. So as the world is looking for business leaders to bring their imagination to solve some of the most important problems that we know that governments alone can't solve, we have people who are devoting themselves to finding solutions for clean water, to education, charter schools. So we have students who literally go out and help society in all walks of life. And I think that's what business schools must be known for.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with top business school deans, two of them brand new, newly minted, about restarting the U.S. economy and the B-school role in that effort. Later this hour, we'll talk about a big court injunction on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But with me right now, the new dean of Harvard Business School, Nithin Noria, is sitting with me since July this year. In Evanston, Illinois, the new dean of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University, Sally Blount, is with us. Also since July, and from Berkeley, California, Richard Lyons is here. Just since July 08, he's dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. Before that, he was chief learning officer at Goldman Sachs. Richard Lyons, take us into what you mean by path bending a little further. The path we're on hasn't felt very good for a lot of people. It's been really good for the, you know, the tip top. We've all seen those numbers, but for a broader number, not so sure. Where do you want to bend the path, Richard?
Well, it's been a very difficult period. All of us know that. If we look at business schools, I like to think of business schools as being a long cycle business. We really do have to think about the human capital, the people that are in the system, the leaders in the system, and what we're going to need over the next 10, 20, 30 years. So when I think about path bending, I have that longer horizon in mind. If we used some quick examples, right? If we said, look, these unsustainabilities that we need to confront as an economy, as a society, are also enormous opportunities. If we look at, for example, what General Electric is doing with their Healthy Imagination or their Eco Imagination programs, these have become absolute focal points. And whether we're thinking about healthcare expenditure and the delivery of healthcare around the world, or whether we are thinking about stewardship for our economy, General Electric is going after these things because they are enormous opportunities, and also because they are working hard to bend the pathways in these two areas that really are unsustainable if a straight line continuation is what the next 20 years is going to bring.
Nithin Noria, I'm reading here, you've been asked about public confidence in business and talking about the questioner asking about how it's diminished in recent years because, I mean, look, you can look at Enron and WorldCom, that whole era, and then what we saw in 08. And I think you're saying here, you know, trust in business is highest when business is seen as doing things that create value for society. Who can argue with that? You say we need to return to creating real value for society. How do we get off that path? How do we get back to it?
So I think that the most important thing that we have to remind all business leaders is that, you know, if they first create value before they claim value, society will in fact trust them. The problem arises when people start claiming value before they create any. And the ways in which you can create value are manifold, all the way from building a product more cheaply to innovating and inventing and creating new products that the society needs, whether it be a fancy product like an iPhone or safe drinking water for millions and millions of people. The opportunities for creating value, and this is what makes business such an extraordinary force for prosperity in society, the opportunities are endless to create value. And as long as business leaders recognize that that's what their primary goal is and that's what society expects from them, and if we educate the next generation of our students to be fully focused on that, I think we will restore trust in business. And
what does that mean, doing differently? Forgive me, but, you know, what do they call insanity is doing the same thing over and over with, you know, without getting the outcome you want. We've seen some rough outcomes here for a lot of people. In the B-school realm, what do you think you need to do differently to get that value outcome?
So I think we allowed our students very often to begin to think that markets were just perfect mechanisms that could allocate capital as well as labor freely and easily. We got caught up, I think, sometimes a little bit in the short-term thinking that has become such an important part of the American economy right now. I think restoring confidence, when Harvard Business School was founded, the first dean of the school said that the real purpose of a business leader is to make a decent profit decently. And if we remind ourselves that when business leaders were considered to be trustworthy, that's what they were trusted for. They were seen as citizens of society who were bringing good things to society, and because they were doing that, society allowed them to keep some of that value that they created for themselves as well. If we just remind people of these fundamentals of what allows business to be a positive force in society, which I think we're trying to do in a wide variety of ways in our curriculum, increasingly at Harvard Business School and across all other business schools, that I think is what will restore faith in business leadership and help bring back the role of business, which can be a very positive force in society.
Sally Blount, I'm looking here. This is in the Wall Street Journal, a quote from James Ellis, who's dean of the University of Southern California's Marshall School. Looking back on what happened with B schools in this economy in the last decade, maybe more, he says, "We taught our students how to look for cracks in the economy, and we taught them how to exploit those cracks," he said. Sally, do the students coming into your program, the new applicants and your grads for that matter now, do they want to make decent profits decently, or do they want to find cracks in society, in the economy, and maybe make them bigger to make a big buck?
You know, by and large, I think if you talk to the young people entering business schools these days, many of them do want to find the answers that are going to change the world and understand that the business enterprise is probably the most effective mechanism we have for creating resources and reallocating resources within our society. And it's amazing if you walk through our halls. I mean, we have people starting not-for-profits. We have people going to Africa to distribute $2 AIDS tests and building businesses around that. We have people starting reading programs called Room to Read. I mean, I think you would be completely heartened if you walked through our halls and saw the kinds of people. It isn't matching the stereotypes of these hard and fast people. It's important when you start talking about business and how we refocus people to remember that business is two things. One, there are markets, and we have been educating people, and we are the central mechanism within higher education to teach people about markets, how they're efficient, how they're inefficient, how do we leverage them better, how do we grow them, how do we make them. And we have become the expert source of that basic training. But we've also, at the very same time, for years, been educating people about how to create strong organizations. And the only way to change the world is through strong organizations. No visionary leader, no charismatic leader can change the world unless they know how to build an organization and a team around them. So I think it's incredibly important not to push the baby out with the bathwater. We've probably helped leverage a bit too much that market discussion, that market analysis. We probably weren't out there enough studying the dangers, talking about the needs of regulation. But boy, we have always been the ones investing in the importance of building strong organizations. And I would argue that we've been doing the right thing there, and we have to continue to do the right thing, because we are the people who understand about how do you use marketing, how do you use management, how do you use accounting, whether it's for profit, whether it's not for profit, or whether it's the public sector. The only way we're going to organize 6 billion people on this globe is by building stronger and better organizations. And human beings have not evolved to the place where that's an intuitive thing to do. We have to teach that. We have to research about it. And we have to constantly question ourselves to push that boundary further. To get this place rebooted, to get the global economy singing so that we can lift all boats is going to take incredible leadership from every corner of the globe and a nuanced understanding of how you build effective organizations. Mm.
Top B-School deans with us today from across the country, Northwestern, Berkeley, Harvard. Let's go to our listeners, Rosalie in Dorset, Vermont. Rosalie, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
And I want to thank all your panelists for addressing this important issue. I just want to start by saying that I did actually go to business school in 84 and 85.
Okay.
I'm new to Vermont from the Massachusetts area.
Yeah.
And nothing spoke to me in the business program because I found that it was all focused on that single bottom line. In 2003, I went to Boston College for a year-long mid-level executive management program called Leadership for Change. And I found my people, and I found those who were talking about the multiple bottom line. And now, after having worked as a consultant with Social Venture Network and being familiar with businesses for social responsibility, and Net Impact, which is a marvelous organization for new business leaders focused on the multiple bottom line.
Take us to your question, Rosalie, or your core observation here.
Sure. I'm finding that I'm advising my son about business school, but finding that many of the business schools I'm looking at with him are putting on, it's the window dressing of the multiple bottom line, and that they're not really leading from the multiple bottom line from their core. If you begin to have more of that sustainable business practices and you're beginning to see those students interested in that multiple bottom line, how do you deal with the disjuncture between the markets with those quarterly profits, the inability to look at long-term goals for business and that emphasis on the economic bottom line?
And you're talking, when you say multiple bottom line, you're talking not just about the profit, but about impact on people, on planet, sort of a holistic view there. Nathan, is there a buyer's market for that when graduates come out of school? Do they care if these graduates are thinking about what's really green or what's really widely healthy for the society, or are they looking for that next profit statement?
So I think as society has gotten so much more interested in questions of sustainability, there are extraordinary opportunities that are being created for businesses to address questions of sustainability. So each company, one of the companies that we work with is Unilever, a great global company. And Unilever, Paul Polman, the CEO, has declared that he wants to double the company's revenues while simultaneously halving the company's environmental footprint. So the senior executives of Unilever came to her business school in a custom program to explore and investigate that question. So serious businesses, mainstream businesses, are beginning to think very much along the lines of saying there shouldn't be anything incompatible between growing the business, continuing to have profitable enterprises, but at the same time, doing really good by questions of environmental sustainability, making sure that we can be good citizens in each of our communities. I think more and more our students are getting exposed to business leaders, case studies, examples of companies that have begun to recognize that it doesn't have to be either or. In fact, the real imagination and the real creativity of leaders is when they can solve these questions as both and. And that's the kind of leadership imagination that we want to have. As Sally was saying, those are the kinds of organizations that we want to build where that kind of creativity is unleashed. There used to be a time, for example, when we used to think that quality and cost went inversely, that, you know, if you had to get higher quality, you had to get higher cost. But through Japanese manufacturing techniques and American thinkers like Deming, we actually learned that you could improve quality while lowering costs because you could reduce wastage. In a similar way, there are many companies that are finding that if you take on sustainability and environmental sustainability an issue, you can actually re-engineer products in ways that not only make them more green, but actually in some cases make them less costly. So this kind of creative imagination where we begin to think of multiple objectives and find solutions that can simultaneously address these multiple objectives is in one of the ways the most important leadership imagination that we're going to require in the future. And that's what I think business schools increasingly, like ours and the others, have to cultivate.
Do it quick. We need it. Brenda in Aiken, South Carolina. Brenda, you're on the air.
Thank you, Tom. I graduated from the University of Chicago Business School in 1975, mm-hmm. and I'm I'm hearing some different language now, but still what seems to underlie the conversation is that we're still going for maximum profit, maximum production of whatever they choose to, whatever they're engaged in, rather than solving for the optimum, because we have to have a new paradigm if we're going to reach the sustainability that's being talked about, because mm-hmm. it sounds to me, I may be hearing it wrong, but it sounds to me like they're talking about sustainability for a company, but we have to really focus on the human cost and the cost to the earth.
Brenda, you got big ideas on the table, and let us pick them straight up, and I'm glad for your call. Richard Lyons, let me come to you with that. I mean, you hear Brenda's hope, and yet the skepticism. Our traditional measures are about profit, and typically the more profit, the better. You're talking about sustainability. How do you train business leaders who can actually bring that in? Because it's hard to measure. You know, businesses sloughed a lot of costs off on the environment, you might even say on people, over a long time. The net benefit has appeared to be good, but now you yourself write that old formula is in trouble. How do you teach new metrics that your students can really, you know, carry with them and that the business world will accept for measuring more broadly?
Well, very important question. I think there are many elements to it. One element, of course, is thinking about the students we select, right? When we talk to our students and we say, why are you making this decision to come here? Almost invariably, they say, I'm looking for fit with my values and my ambitions. Mm-hmm. And it's very important that we think about values in a very significant way. What exactly is the set of values that define your school? Have you taken a stand on them? Do they have elements within them that not everybody's going to like, i.e., are you taking a real stand or aren't you? And other elements, your first caller talked about the Net Impact Club, right? And that is the largest student club at Berkeley. It probably is at other schools as well. We are attracting, as a group of schools, a lot more students that are very, very interested in this. As we think about how we frame what they're doing in the program and think about the sorts of metrics and skills that we can deliver. One example, if I may, if we thought about systems thinking, are students able to think about thinking, what in the jargon we call metacognition? Can our students say, no, in fact, it is not 3 liters of water that you consume as a producer to produce that 1 liter of beverage, but closer to 300 liters of water, because many of your suppliers are using corn syrup and the sugar cane needs to get grown, et cetera.
Right.
Can
mm-hmm.
they see that larger context? And that's one of the skill sets that I think we deliver much more effectively than we used to.
I mean, as a dean, you're sitting there, you got a Goldman Sachs background. Are you afraid if I teach too much sustainability, you know, the guys at Goldman Sachs are going to look at what I'm turning out and turn away from it, or say, you're not giving us the kind of hard chargers we need to go in and find those cracks in the economy and make our returns, Dean Lyons?
Well, I can't speak for Goldman Sachs. Let me try and speak more broadly than that. I think every firm in the economy is starting to recognize what reputation risk really means, right? Mm-hmm. I think people are saying, look, if we aren't thinking responsibly and leading responsibly and being sensitive on a lot of these elements, then what we thought was maximizing profits isn't even close. What we thought was maximizing shareholder wealth isn't even close. And I think that's one of the major lessons of the last 5 years, is that think very hard about reputation and make sure that you are acting in a way that people feel is reflecting a genuine sense of stewardship.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with top business school deans from around the country about restarting the U.S. economy and the B School role in that effort. Nithin Noria, Harvard Business School, is with us. Sally Blount, Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern. Richard Lyons, Dean of the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. We've got a lot of online comment here. Here's Jeff, says, I do agree with the statement that a good business leader is someone who makes a decent profit decently. However, in today's climate of sharks and winners take all attitude, it's clear to me this is a quaint notion. We'll ask about that. Here's Heather, who says, what about the multitude of MBAs who are making progress on a smaller scale, adding to up to a huge impact? She says, I'm a Wharton MBA who is now a stay-at-home mom, putting my skills to work as a volunteer, helping to bend the path right there at the school level. And let's get John from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. John, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
So I teach business ethics at a small school, and I have a concern that your speakers or your guests, who I have to say, I'm very encouraged by what they say. It's wonderful to hear that you have students with big ideas who really want to make it work and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That's fantastic. But I'm concerned that you have the top students at the top schools. And that's not all of the business people in America. It's, yes, it's an important sector of it, but it's not the biggest sector of it. And I'm not convinced that all of my students, and I'm new to my school in South Carolina, so
okay.
I'm hoping that it's a great group of students, but I'm just concerned that at the non-big schools that you're not going to have the big ideas. You're going to have people whose parents are not very wealthy, and they just want to make sure that they can afford, you know, a life for their family, and then they are therefore going to be concerned about predominantly the bottom line. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it absolutely makes sense. Richard Lyons, let me bring it to you. I mean, I think what John's pointing to is, you know, there was for a long time a pretty wide-held faith in this country, you know. I mean, what's good for GM is good for America, that if we did business well, did smart business, made decent profits, that would be good for the whole country. Now you're talking about bending the path, but, you know, does that still add up to putting, you know, bacon on the table? And can everybody take that attitude, or is that a privilege of, I don't know, elite school grads? Richard?
Perfectly fair question. I think one of the piece that you mentioned earlier, Tom, on path-bending leadership that was in The Economist,
yep,
was in fact an address that I gave to a group of people that was an industry-wide association of all business schools called GMAC, GMAC. And, you know, there every business school or potentially was represented. So we're having this discussion at the very least at the broadest levels, our industry and trade associations as business schools. These sorts of issues are on the docket and are getting discussed. Now, that's not a complete answer to your question. The notion is, what does a person on the ground in one of these programs see and hear and think and do? And I think we have to think hard about it. My own view is that this is a kind of ethos shift or gestalt shift,
mm-hmm,
that people at business schools sort of across the board are thinking about these things more deeply than they used to, though there may be a differential, as the caller points out, between some of the schools that are getting the strongest students and those that aren't.
Let's hear from another one of those. CMAC is calling from New Britain, Connecticut. CMAC, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm dean of the School of Business at Central Connecticut State University in New Britain. And I'm wondering if my colleagues could help us. We are not an Ivy League school, but it seems to me that in most Ivy League business schools, we are training basically apolitical technocrats who are so divorced from many other social issues and the basic environment. Looking at the economy right now, when 97% of the people and population make less than $250,000, the top 1% of the population takes 23% of our GDP, how do we expect to stimulate consumer spending when the economy is producing for the masses? So I think we have done a disservice to the business leadership in this country by basically making them apolitical. Where are the Rockefellers of today? How come we could not, you know, train people like that who are after profit but they also feel responsible that the system has to sustain itself, and we have to make sure that the structure is flexible enough to respond to these secular trends.
I think is maybe the
right way to go.
C-Mac, you raise a great point, and I'm very grateful for your call. Nathan Noria, there's a fellow dean from a smaller school, and he says, well, okay, you hear his question. He's wondering if you're training the sort of vanguard of perpetuating the problems we have with income distribution in this country. What about an apolitical sort of technocrats here? Does that cut it? Does that perpetuate the problems we already have when it comes to inequality?
So I think we have always had at Harvard Business School courses that talk about the relationship between business and society. Quite recently, we've created a new required first-year course, so all of our students have to take it, called Leadership and Corporate Accountability, in which we remind students that all businesses must, at the very least, to be successful or sustainable over the long run, meet the demands of three constituencies. They are businesses, so they do have to meet the economic demands of making a profit, but also they operate in an environment that is where there's regulations, where there's laws, and these laws are constantly changing, and if business acts in a way that is irresponsible, those laws will be more onerous, as we've just seen with financial regulations. Mm-hmm. So we ask people that always behave not at the edge of the law, but at the interior of the law, so that you don't get regulation that ends up being overreaching. But we also remind that businesses operate at the will of society, and they have to earn the legitimacy of society, that if they destroy trust in society, then the license to operate can be taken away from them. So in many ways, we're trying to cultivate the kind of imagination that the caller asks for, where our business leaders recognize that thinking narrowly, that all they have to do is to be technocrats that run the profit and loss account of a business, is actually being irresponsible as stewards and leaders of a business, because business does operate in a regulatory and social sphere, and great leaders are very attentive to that. And when business is at its best, it's because it has earned a reputation of not just making a good profit, but also doing it in a way that is responsible to the regulations that exist and to society more broadly.
There's going to be an eye on those grads and on you, maybe like never before, at least right now. Sally Blount, maybe last one goes to you. I'm reading your blog here. You're just back not long ago from a big conference of women in Washington, D.C., a Fortune magazine, you know, powerful leaders, hearing from Warren Buffett. What's he got to say about the restart of the economy, Sally? And what about women in B School, women in American business, and their role in your training?
Warren Buffett is always witty and insightful and nuanced. He made a wonderful comment that I had talked about in that blog about how, you know, the 80-some or however old he is. I don't want to misstate who it is. But he's been alive for a third of our country's duration, which
That's
is a
amazing.
Very, very
we
powerful
We are still a
thought.
Young nation. That is true.
We are a really young nation. And I found that very intriguing. And there were many other interesting speakers at the conference. Obama addressed us as well. It was a great opportunity.
Women in business, are you training
women
them in equal numbers to
a,
men? Will they have the high jobs? Will they change business?
It's a fascinating question that you ask, because right now women make up about a third of the MBA students across the country, no matter what sector and type of school you look at. Whereas in the law and the medical professions, they're at a full 50%. And we know at the feeder university level, women at the top programs are over at least 50% or over that. And one of the interesting challenges we all have is how do we get that education out to more women, like we talked about from Wharton, who are out educating our children, who are out in the community making things happen in the not-for-profit environment. Building strong organizations is important at every sector of society. It's important in every cultural niche, every religious place. We have to figure out how to attract more women and make them understand that it is not a cutthroat to build strong organizations, that it is an important social mission that we can all engage in. So that's part of changing our vision and changing society's view of us about what we do.
We're not just cutthroat. Maybe you'll that may be the last word. You may be the beacon for that right there outside Chicago. Sally Blount, Dean of the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University. Sally, it's great to hear your voice again. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
And Dean Richard Lyons, the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. Dean Lyons, good luck there. Thank you very much. Bend that path.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
And Nitin Noria with me in the studio today, Dean of Harvard Business School. It's great to have you all here today, and thank you very much for your time, Dean Noria.
Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, there you've got it, the view from top business school deans right across the country. In a moment, we'll hear about the new global injunction against the Pentagon's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on gays in the military. This is On Point. In California yesterday, federal judge Virginia Phillips issued an injunction banning the enforcement of Don't Ask, Don't Tell worldwide. The 17-year-old policy, she wrote, quote, infringes the fundamental rights of United States service members, unquote, and violates their rights of due process, she said, and freedom of speech. It's a big victory for gay rights activists, but will it stand? Joining me now from New York is John Schwartz. He is the national legal correspondent for the New York Times. John Schwartz, thanks very much for being here.
Hey there.
So here we are. It's the morning after. There's an injunction. I guess that's to take place right now, even for procedures that may have been underway within the U.S. military all over the world. Is that right?
That's right, unless there's an instant request for a stay, which the government might ask for. The ban takes effect.
Stay of this injunction, if there's a request for that, would it have to come from the DOJ, the Department of Justice?
Department of Justice would have to do it, that's right. As they say, they traditionally defend laws passed by Congress unless blatantly unconstitutional. Even if the president has said he doesn't like the laws, the president has said he doesn't like this law, he's asked Congress to repeal it, but the Department of Justice traditionally defends such measures. Same way that they've just filed an appeal in the Massachusetts case over the Defense of Marriage Act.
It's a political problem because, as you say, the president has said he's like to see this policy go away. Now the judge has said, okay, fine, it's gone. Do they stay or not? They've got quite a while to do that. It seems like there's a good chance they would wait until after the midterm elections if they're going to issue a stay.
Well, they certainly could. They've got 60 days to appeal. And so conceivably they could wait till after the election. It's a difficult situation for the president politically, of course, because a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. There are people who are very upset that Don't Ask, Don't Tell would go away, and yet there are also people who are furious with the president for defending a law that even he says he doesn't like.
A further really interesting wrinkle, of course, is that this case, out of which grew this injunction, was brought by Republicans, log cabin Republicans. That means gay Republicans. What about the legal arguments here, John? If there's not a stay on this injunction, but let's say it's appealed, and presumably it's you tell us the likelihood of an appeal. But what about the legal arguments? Has this judge, Virginia Phillips, made arguments that a higher court would have difficult overruling or not?
Well, the judge established through the findings of fact a factual record that has got to be taken into account that discussed whether or not there's a effect pro or con, good or bad, through the Don't Ask, Don't Tell. The judge determined that, as a matter of factual record, that Don't Ask, Don't Tell hurts the military, hurts preparedness, hurts readiness, hurts cohesion, and whether or not a higher court agrees with the law or not, those are the facts that are in the record. It'll be interesting to see what a higher court does with that. The questions that will come up for a higher court to determine are, did she apply the proper standard of review for these laws in finding them unconstitutional? Did she give enough deference to the government in its decision to enact such rules? And so upon review, the government could make the case that whatever the facts are, the constitutional review was incorrectly handled and the law should stand.
You're pointing there to the factual record, whether or not Don't Ask, Don't Tell hurts cohesion within the military. But maybe this is too broad, but our eye falls to this basic statement that she made here, that this policy infringes the fundamental rights of United States service members. If that's her finding, can you go back and overturn that procedurally, or would ultimately, I don't know, where will this end up? Some federal appeal court or the Supreme Court? They have to look at the fundamental constitutional question.
Well, it is a constitutionally decided case, and it will move up the chain. The first appeal from here is to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, unless they ask the judge to review her own ruling.
Mm-hmm.
At the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, it would go to a three-judge panel. which would hear arguments and decide, again, based on findings of law, less likely to review the findings of fact. And then that would get, if that, you know, either way, either side could appeal the decision to the en banc, you know, larger mm-hmm. group of judges on the Ninth Circuit. And then after that, it could go to the Supreme Court.
Does the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals have a reputation one way or the other when it comes to politically hot decisions?
Well, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals is widely thought of as the most liberal of the national circuits. There are Jimmy Carter appointed 15 judges back in the day, and that created a pretty strong liberal bloc. In the years since, and this is it's become a favorite talking point of conservatives to say the crazy Ninth, the mm-hmm. nutty Ninth, the liberal Ninth Circuit. Actually, you know, there have been several presidents since then, and Republican presidents have appointed several very conservative members of the court as well. And so that three-judge panel can be made up of strong liberals, strong
yeah.
conservatives.
Right.
Luck of the draw can get you any possible combination. And so it's a far less predictable court than it ever, if it ever was a predictably liberal court.
Interesting.
Although there are liberal judges on that court, you can't predict where it's going to come out. Mm. And even the, I might be getting too technical here, but even the en banc process,
mm-hmm.
en banc is supposed to mean you get all the judges together from the circuit and they make a decision together.
Right.
The Ninth has so many judges that they take a portion of them, only 11. And so, again, you get luck of the draw, and again, you get the possibility upon appeal that it's a weighted conservative or weighted liberal based on luck of the draw. So it's just a very unpredictable circuit at this point.
So don't ask, don't tell, all on the line right now, but a worldwide injunction against the policy, and we'll be watching with a little better understanding thanks to you, John. John Schwartz, national legal correspondent for The New York Times, joining us from New York. John, thank you very much for your time today.
It's a pleasure, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for joining us this hour. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.